accession number 15450, reel 2.
Commander Grenfell, reel 2.
So there I was, 22 years of age, leading seaman, being asked to decide whether this equipment was good enough. I was satisfied, so I signed for it, and soon after we left to go to Bangor in Northern Ireland. And there we did a trial shooting off the aircraft. We had two pilots on board, naturally, one on duty, one off duty. One was a South African, Ian Hay, and the other was a Canadian, McDonald was his name. And everything went off very well, and we sailed up to Valfjord near Iceland. I think we were one of the first ships in Valfjord on this occasion, but as days went by, more and more ships arrived, until we had 34 ships, a very, very large convoy. And then there started arriving cruisers, destroyers, and we sailed for Murmansk on the 21st of May, 1942. And this was PQ-16. All of these outgoing convoys had the initials PQ, and the convoys returning from Murmansk had the initials QP. So this was PQ-16. We sailed on the 21st of May. 34 ships, and the Commodore was Commodore Gale, and he was in the ship, merchant ship, the Ocean Voice, and he was the Commodore of the convoy. After we had sailed from Valfjord, we were then joined by not the full escort, but partly by the escort, and that was the Allenbank. She was an Ekek ship, the destroyers, the Shanty, the Achates, the Volunteer, and the Polish destroyer, the Garland. There were also the corvettes, the Honeysuckle, the Starwort, the Hyderabad, the French ship, the Rosalies, and the submarines, the Trident and the Seawolf. And we sailed. We sailed on, and the officer then in charge of the escort, and really what that meant, the whole convoy in effect, was Captain Onslow, a very famous, well-known destroyer captain during the last war. And he was in the destroyer Ashanti. We were then later joined by the heavy escort, and those were the cruisers Nigeria, the Norfolk, the Kent, the Liverpool, and the destroyers, the Orabai and the Marne. And Rear Admiral Burrows was the officer commanding the heavy escort, and because of his rank, he was in charge of the whole shooting match. We sailed. That was on the 21st. We had an easy time when we sailed, nothing very much. Don't forget, it was May, and it wasn't so cold as it was in that first convoy, the December of 1941, but it was still cold. We were going in a northerly direction all the time. At 1900, on the 23rd of May, we were spotted by a German shadower. It was either a Focke-Wulf or a Blumenvoss, I've forgotten. We were quite accustomed to this, because I remember it during other convoys, that the shadower would fly around the convoy, and nearly always in a clockwise direction. He'd just fly round and round outside gun range, and we never fired at him. We knew it was just pointless. We knew, of course, he was reporting back our position. And it's hard to believe, but it's fact, that we would speak to each other with the Morse lamp. The sort of thing would the captain would say, good day, so the signaller from the bridge of the ships would signal good day by Morse lamp, and back would come an answer, always in English, good day, a bit cold today, isn't it, and this sort of thing. And on one occasion, the captain, I'm going back to now, to the Edinburgh, when this happened on the Edinburgh, the captain, who was a wonderful man, Captain Faulkner, he came on the bridge and he saw this shadow flying round and round, and he said to the signalman, please tell that German to fly the other way around. He's making me dizzy. And the signalman, whether in fact the captain meant it as a joke or not, I don't know. But the signalman thought the captain was quite serious about it. So he signalled, please go the other way around. You're making the captain dizzy. And in a matter of a couple of seconds, the aircraft turned round and signalled back, anything to oblige, and went anti-clockwise around the convoy. So that's how it was with this convoy now going up north in May 1942, that we spoke to the shadower. And it wasn't until a couple of days later, 25th of May, was the first attacks, and out came Heinkel torpedo bombers and Ju-88 dive bombers. Their attacks were not pressed home very well, because we had a very, very heavy anti-aircraft barrage, and it was a bit dangerous for them to come anywhere near the ships. However, they did manage to get through, and they hit one ship, and that was the Syros, S-Y-R-O-S, and she was very badly damaged, and later she sank. 25th of the 5th, it wasn't until the evening of that day that the attacks became so bad that we decided to fire off the Hurricane. And there was nearly a stand-up fight between the Canadian and the South African who should take it off, because it was just the time when they were changing over watches. However, the South African won, Ian Hay, and he was shot off, and a great burst of fire, because they were shot off by 14 rockets. And off he went in the direction of the incoming Heinkels, the Heinkel torpedo bomber, because they were extremely dangerous. And then, naturally, during the whole trip, my RDF was continually in use, picking up incoming attacks. But here we were, now doing the job we were really meant to be doing. We had picked up this incoming raid of Heinkels, we shot off the Sea Hurricane, and we had on board a Lieutenant RMVR, and he was a fighter direction officer. And he took over then, with all the information I was passing him about the position of our Hurricane and the position of the incoming aircraft, to guide the Hurricane out to the Heinkels. And he shot down one Heinkel, and he was coming down. He'd come up from below, and he'd shot down one. He was coming down to attack him again, and he badly damaged a second Heinkel, but the Heinkel hit him. So he was badly damaged, the Sea Hurricane. The Sea Hurricane then flew back over the convoy to come as near as possible to try to either ditch or to come down by parachute as near as possible to one of our ships. And it is said, I cannot guarantee this, but many books are written about this, that as he flew over the convoy, some American ships, we had American ships in the convoy, they weren't quite sure of the situation, and they fired at the Hurricane, and they hit him again, and he came down on the water. He was very fortunate, because he hit the water near the destroyer Volunteer, and the destroyer Volunteer, as quickly as possible, had lowered a boat, and they managed to get him out very, very badly wounded, and he was later decorated with the Distinguished Flying Cross. He was the South African.
What were you doing at the time?
With the radar. We did watches. We did watch. The normal watch for radar was just watching out for aircraft. Was 2 hours on, 2 hours off. But when you came to action stations, you couldn't spend more than half an hour watching this sort of fluorescent screen. Half an hour on, half an hour off. And we would spend a half an hour on the radar screen, and a half an hour off, and so on. And we were, during the whole time, we were down in the radar office or up in the transmitter office having a rest, but always on the radar. Nothing to do with the guns or anything like that, because they had their own DEMS gunners.
Did the equipment work properly?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, absolutely. I'll come into that in a moment. And then came the 26th, and that was the worst day of all. It is estimated, we heard about it at the time, and when I was up on deck during my period when I was not down below on the radar screen, you could see it. We were attacked, they reckon, by 220 aircraft that day, which is continual attacks. Just went on and on and on. And there were several ships sunk. I can only remember some of the names. The Stary Bolshevika, she was a Russian ship. She wasn't sunk, she was very badly damaged. And she struggled on, and she did eventually reach Murmansk. There was another ship, I think it was the Carlton, an American ship, and she was sunk. And there were a couple of other ships badly hit during these attacks. That was the worst day. And it must have been probably about 5 o'clock. We just had an attack, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and suddenly the RDF went off the screen. And unfortunately, these things do often happen. It was pure coincidence. The only other ship with long-range radar was the AKAC ship, Allenbank. And she had signaled only a short while before that her RDF had gone off the air. So we were the only ship with RDF covering the whole of the convoy. And there we were. Suddenly our RDF went off the air, as he called it then. And the captain sent for me and said, well, what do we do now? And so I looked up to the aerials, and I'd had this once before in the Edinburgh. I borrowed a pair of glasses, of binoculars, and I looked up at the mainmast. That was the transmitting aerial. And I could see that the feeder cables had been shot through. They'd been parted. So I explained this to the captain. He said, well, look, he said, we have to have radar. We're the only ship now with radar. The Allenbank is relying on us. And he had reported to the Allenbank that our radar was also defunct. So I volunteered to go up to the top of the mast with the radio mechanic. I had a radio mechanic on board. And it was really cold. Freezing. We were right up by the ice on our port side. We could see the ice. We were by the ice, and we tried always to go as far north as possible, to remain as far as possible outside the range of the attacking aircraft from Norway. And it was really cold. So we went up there, and I repaired the feeder cables. That wasn't an easy job because our hands were absolutely numb. And when we were up there, an attack developed, and that, I must say, was a really frightening experience. We were at the top of the mast, and I'm not saying that the German aircraft could see us, the top of the mast, but they were attacking the convoy, and there was nothing more we could do but to just crouch down behind the mast, or what we thought was behind the mast, depended on the direction the aircraft was coming from, and hope that nothing happened. In fact, there, during one of the attacks, something did happen, and that was the mast, about 6 feet below where we were standing, was hit. It wasn't absolutely sort of shot through, but it had a very nasty sort of gap in the mast. So we then, when this attack was over, we carried on, and we completed the repair, came down to the deck again, and we were sent for by the captain. The captain, who was a wonderful man, he gathered all his officers together, and he said, because we were then back on the air and we were able to detect incoming aircraft, and he said, gentlemen, he said, that was a very, very brave thing we have just seen done. And he said that he would be recommending me and the radio mechanic for a decoration for bravery in the face of the enemy. And he sent this officer, Second Officer Hulse, down to some store to fetch a keg of rum. And he filled up a damn good cup of rum, one for the radio mechanic, one for myself, and I think they also had some rum, and we all drank to what we had just done. So we then carried on, giving warning. The attacks went on and on and on. There was no night at all. And then the next day, there was a period of 2 or 3 hours in the early morning when there wasn't very much going on. And then the attack started again on the 27th. And that was again. It was dreadful. Just one attack after another. And by this time, of course, we were giving warning all the time. It was usually, depending on the height of the aircraft, 50 miles, 60 miles, but it was time enough to man the guns and make sure that everything was in preparation. We knew the direction from which the attack was coming. And this went on the whole time until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I shall never, never forget it. And I had just left the radar office, and it was my half an hour off. And I went up on the upper deck, and I was standing in the upper deck watching what was going on. And then we heard the roar of aircraft. And we looked at the stern. Noise was coming from that direction. We looked at the stern, and there was a Ju-88 dive bomber coming straight at us. And you wouldn't believe it, but I actually saw the head of the pilot. I saw him in the cockpit with his goggles and everything. And he came down at us, machine gunning all the way. Machine gun bullets were hitting the bulkheads, the side of the ship, and so on. It didn't hit us. I think we were about three or four of us together. We all went down on a heap on the deck and just lay there. And then seconds afterwards, there was this tremendous bang, and he dropped a bomb. And it hit number two hold, which was just ahead of the bridge, and the fore side of the bridge. And it hit the hold, and there was ammunition in the hold, and this exploded. The ship just lifted up and then sank back into the sea, and then, you know, wavered, and then slowly went down by the bow. But we didn't sink. Went down by the bow. The captain then signaled abandon ship, because we were sinking. And we took to the boats, and I went to a boat on the starboard side, and we started piling into this boat, and the boat was being lowered, and we had just hit the water when there was the roar of aircraft, and down came, we could see it, down came, I estimate, five, and in books written about it since, they say it was three aircraft, but I reckon it was five aircraft came at us, and we could see the bombs coming, and there was the most unearthly explosion that, well, as a matter of fact, it's a strange thing, I didn't hear it, but other people who heard it from other ships said it was the most dreadful explosion. When you're near an explosion, you don't hear anything at all. It was all I can remember was just flying through the air, and as I was flying through the air, it probably was only seconds, but it seems a long time when things like that are happening. I could see, as I was going through the air, huge shapes flying through the air with me, chunks of metal, and there was one shape that looked like the funnel of the ship flying through the air. And then the next thing I knew, I was in the water, and it was freezing. And I went down, and I heard about it later, of course I didn't know, that the ship just exploded and went down with a great gush. It went down, and I was dragged down with it. Of course, I didn't know that at the time. I was dragged down, and I was well and truly down, and I was in a tangle of ropes and everything. And I can tell you, I am a Christian, but that time I did pray. I really did. And it seemed impossible. I was holding my breath, and it was dark, dark green. I opened my eyes a couple of times, and then I absolutely shot to the surface. And again later, when this was discussed with people who had saved us, they reckon what had happened was that when the ship went down, her boilers burst when she was deeper in the water, and it was this rush of water that shot a lot of us up to the surface. Otherwise we'd have never got to the surface. And I can remember it clearly. I was looking up, and I could see the sea becoming clearer until it became white, the white of the sky, and then I came through. And then a dreadful thing happened. I'd reached the surface, my prayers had been answered, and I started going down again. I had a life belt, but they weren't the life belts that you have today. It was just Kapok, and they didn't keep you afloat very well. And I felt myself going down again. It was my right arm was going down, and I started going down. I was sort of gulping for air, and I went down again in the water. And then I sort of kicked with my feet, and I came up to the surface again. I pulled my arm up, and I found that there was a hand hanging on to my pullover. It wasn't a pullover, it was a I suppose you'd call it a pullover. It was hanging on to the arm of a navy blue pullover. And I pulled it up, and this was a body, and he was dead. There was no doubt about that. His head was split right down the middle, and I could see I could do nothing for him. I just undid his arm and pushed him off, and then I started swimming, cold, and although the sea was not so rough, it was rough enough that when you're in the water, you couldn't see very far. The next wave, although the wave might only be 2 feet or 3 feet high, it was enough so that you weren't able to see clearly. But every time I came up on a wave, I could see, and I could see a chunk of wood. A barrel. And I swam in this direction. I'm a good swimmer, by the way. I swam in the direction of the barrel, and I got to the barrel. It was a petrol drum or something like that. And I suppose it would sound comical now, but I tried to heave myself in the barrel, and it just turned over. And this went on several times, going round and round and round. And I realized that it was no good at all. When I was up in the barrel once, I could see a boat, a lifeboat, an upturned lifeboat, with two, they could have been bodies, I don't know, on the keel, lying across the keel of this upturned lifeboat. So I decided to take the risk. I was getting very, very cold and my legs were becoming numb. So I started swimming in the direction of this lifeboat. And by the time I reached that lifeboat, I can tell you, I now have had experience of what it's like to suffer from overexposure to cold water, because the whole of my body, from the hips downward, were practically useless. They were absolutely numb, and I could feel this cold creeping up. And it was with the greatest difficulty I managed to get myself onto that lifeboat. I must say the two chaps on board didn't help me very much, and I can understand it now too. They were probably shocked or only too glad to be alive, and I managed to get myself on that lifeboat. That would have been, I estimate, 20 minutes after the sinking that I got onto that lifeboat. We're on the lifeboat, and the three of us then all together, and we couldn't move very much in case the thing toppled, and we saw a JU-88 come across the convoy. Don't forget, there was a lot of smoke and everything. So when this was discussed later in Russia, no one criticized this. The pilot came across the convoy, or at least the scene of the sinking, and there were a couple of corvettes had come back to help the survivors. He came across machine gunning all the way, and he dropped two bombs. So several of the survivors who were still in the water died from machine gunning. We discovered this later, and died from the pressure wave from the bombs. We were lucky. We were on this boat, so we escaped all of that. About, I should say, not quite a half an hour later, the corvette Hyderabad came alongside, or was near as possible to us, couldn't come alongside, and lowered a boat, and we were rescued, taken on board. We heard at the time that of the 84 men in the ship's company, only 16 had been saved. That's what we heard at the time. And we were taken aboard the Hyderabad, and naturally some of them were badly wounded, dreadfully wounded. And funny thing was that I only had cuts, bruises, and suffering from exposure. So they took me down to a bunk, tucked up the bunk, and as always, the sailors were tremendous. They gave us their clothing to keep us warm, and they gave us their bunks where we could sleep. They had to do without their bunks. And then we carried on. We could hear the attacks going on all the time. And it wasn't until the 30th of May that we arrived in Murmansk. And we went in through Kola Inlet, and this time we went right up to Murmansk. And not only the Hyderabad, there were other ships that had rescued survivors from other ships, not only from the Empire Lawrence, and we were all landed in the docks in Murmansk. And it was a dreadful sight. It had been bombed time and time again, Murmansk, wreckage everywhere, and we were placed, there were hundreds of us, survivors, we were placed in an empty warehouse. And I think it must have been about 10 o'clock at night. Of course, there was no night, but my recollection was it was about 10 o'clock at night. And we lay there, some were moaning and groaning. There were a couple of Royal Naval medical officers from ships amongst us, and then came the Russian Russian people. I must say, they weren't particularly friendly. They did what they could for us, but there was no comradeship at all. And there was no haste. They didn't do anything to quickly get us to hospital. I estimate we lay there for something like 6 hours before the first ambulances arrived. We were loaded aboard the ambulances and we drove through the streets of Murmansk. And I was never in the First World War, although I've seen pictures of the First World War, and I'm sure that those streets that we drove through were like some street in a shelled out town in France during the 1914-18 war. There were bomb holes everywhere, and we drove with a taxi and we were being joggled everywhere. The people were badly wounded, they just had to put up with the pain, and we went round bomb holes up onto the pavement to get round bomb holes until we came to the hospital. The hospital had been damaged, was a little bit away from the docks, had been damaged. The windows were all blown out. It was just boards at the windows. And we were taken into this hospital. And this was a hospital for Russian soldiers from the Finnish front, which was only a matter of 20, 30 kilometers away. And they'd be brought back wounded. And it was absolutely full. The wards were full. The passages were full. And there were beds along the passages. And all our people were just taken to various wards in the passages, and I wasn't so very badly hurt. I lay down in a bed in one of the passages, and they sort of tended to my cuts and bruises and all the rest of it. And they decided, of course, that there was nothing wrong with me, and I was released a few hours later, probably about 5 hours later, along with other people who weren't so badly wounded, and we were sent to a camp just on the other side of the river from Murmansk, directly opposite Murmansk. It wasn't a village, it was just a Russian army camp. And that was my first home, I could call it if you like, in Russia, was this camp. And also Lieutenant Hulse, who was the only executive officer to survive the Empire Lorns, he was also in this camp. So I'll make a little break there because I'm getting a bit tired of throat. So, we were in this camp, and Murmansk was bombed so often, every day, which is unbelievable. But when an attack developed, we could see the barrels, massive long barrels. I've never seen anti-aircraft guns with such long barrels. They would come out from various positions, mainly in the forest, and they'd fire away at these attacking German aircraft. I had seen air attacks in Portsmouth when I was in the barracks there, but I've never seen so many German aircraft shot down by anti-aircraft fire as I did over Murmansk. They just came tumbling out of the sky during these attacks. We were on the other side of the river, but there were one or two bombs landed near us as well. In this camp, there were merchant seamen from other convoys that had been sunk. And there were some Mexicans, I remember that clearly. They had been with American merchant ships, and there were Americans there. And it wasn't a very pleasant atmosphere. So I decided, I was the senior naval rating of all of the naval ratings there. I had nothing to do with the merchant seamen, because that was second officer Hulse. He was responsible for the merchant seamen, but I was responsible for the naval rating.